Leia, the reason we're going to have this talk today, the reason we're going to talk about hot flashes or hot flushes, depending what you call them, and cancer care, is you made a comment to me, and I thought it was funny.
And I don't remember what that comment was.
But you said, when we started a phone call, you came on, you're like, oh, I had ice cream last night, and I couldn't sleep.
Oh, that's right.
And I laughed, because I was like, what does ice cream and sleep have to do with one another?
Because you do not experience the hot flashes.
Right. Yes, exactly. So everything I know about hot flashes is, okay, I will admit it, mostly academic, because I'm fortunate that I don't have them yet anyways. So it opened up a whole conversation about hot flashes, what causes them and how to control them and the do's and don'ts and what's going on physiologically.
And I'd seen a post about someone recommending a medication that was like in a phase 3 trial. And we both were like, oh my God, weight gain. That kind of like spurred like that whole conversation. So hot flashes, hot flashes in the cancer patient, I guess.
Yes.
That's why we're here today.
Yeah. And we're going to stick mostly to breast cancer, right?
Mostly to breast cancer. Some of it can apply because prostate cancer is
sure.
You know, that's the big one for patients. I always found that more challenging. Some of this can apply for patients with prostate cancer, but yeah, we're mostly sticking with breast cancer.
And just for the record, breast cancer and prostate cancer are the second most common cancers behind lung cancer. So this applies to a whole lot of people.
Right. And when patients have like temperature fluctuations with lung cancer and other cancers, it's not always related to the same things as with these
okay. Cancers. So fair to say, we will stick to hormonal causes.
Yes. We will stick to hormonal causes.
All right. That's fair. Because there's other immunological reasons and lymphomas and leukemias and you know, what are called B symptoms in the case of lymphomas. And so we're not going there today. We're just going to stick to the hormonal type.
Exactly.
Okay.
And these can also be used with, not that we're prescribing anything, but like I have used these same things for patients that an oncologist said, we need to take them off of their hormone replacement. And what can you do, naturopathically, integratively, what can you do? So I have used these with patients outside of, a breast cancer or prostate cancer setting, but that's what we're sticking to.
Sounds good.
Nice.
So I'm Tina Kaser. I'm a naturopathic physician doing cancer care for just about, 20 something years. So my whole thing is just helping patients, and hopefully through our discussions, we will reach enough people to move a few needles and help people through their symptoms, whether they're in treatment or after treatment. Today's discussion is on hot flashes.
I'm Leia Sherman, and I'm a naturopathic physician. I have worked not quite as long in cancer care. I also am certified in yoga for cancer, focusing on supporting patients as they go through treatment, beyond treatment, wherever they're at in their cancer continuum. I work with cancer patients on that. And I'm a cancer survivor. Duh. I had breast cancer. Hello. So I am I'm not the guinea pig. What am I?
That
works, or it didn't work with me, and it worked with me, and who knows? Like I don't know what to call. Yeah,
you're keeping it real.
I'm keeping it real. I'm keeping it real.
If I fly off into some academic or theoretical thought, you can bring me back down and say, "Yeah, but it doesn't work that way."
Yeah, we need one of those things that they have on like DJ shows where you like hit the button and it goes scream. Like,
oh yeah,
freaks on it.
Screech. I want a soundboard.
Soundboard. There you go.
Love it.
I always pictured them to be like cartridges, like Betamax cartridges that they kind of put in.
You're showing your age, man. Most people don't know what a Betamax is.
Sorry. Ow. Sorry if I have noise in the background.
Quite all right.
My phone ringing, whatnot. Okay.
We'll do it.
So we have introduced ourselves. We have introduced our subject, and we will add that we may be doctors, but we're not your doctor. And so we're talking about things that we have used in our practice. We're not prescribing anything. We don't know anything about you. If this is something that's interesting, write down a little note and take it to your doctor, because that's our disclaimer. We are not treating you.
Yep. Don't mistake our conversation for medical advice, because we're not doling that out today.
No, we're just having a talk.
And you're listening in on it. And this is the Cancer Pod. Did we even mention that?
No, this is the Cancer Pod.
We should mention
the Cancer Pod.
That is where you are at right now. So you're at the Cancer Pod. So let's talk more about hot flashes. So where should we start? You want to start with anatomy of a hot flash? You want to start with your ice cream story? I think let's start with your ice cream story.
My ice cream story? Okay, so I had ice cream the other night. It was really hot, and we went out and got these really good gluten-free waffle cones. And then I had some, okay, I'm going to mention brands, and I'm not really promoting them, but I might be. No, I'm not. we had some oat ice cream, maybe Oatly, because it's really delicious. So it was a non-dairy ice cream, and I had it late. I tried to eat before a certain hour. I wanted ice cream. We had some ice cream, and I had a miserable night's sleep, and I just woke up hot and sweaty and uncomfortable. And so, I mean, there are multiple things going on, because there is sugar in that ice cream. And that sugar can cause a lot of different issues. And one of them is hot flashes. So that's kind of my ice cream story. And we'll get more into triggers and stuff, but that is definitely one of my triggers, is sugar. So
no ice cream the next night?
No ice cream the next night. I mean, every once in a while I want some ice cream and I have it, and I kind of pay the price. I kind of know what's going to happen.
I feel like adults have that right. You know, when I know that foods make me worse, or I have a patient and we find out some foods make them worse, cause inflammation or some other reason, and they decide to eat it, I figure, you know, there's action and consequence. And if they're willing to deal with the consequence, then they can take that action.
Right. Like, you go into it knowing that there's something's going to happen. And so what I tend to do, on the rare occasion I do indulge in ice cream, is I try to have it early in the day. And so that way I can go for a walk, I can do something and just make sure that it's mostly out of my, you know, my system, my blood sugar is more regulated at night. So my husband and I were joking about ice cream for breakfast is probably the best. Best thing, but I'm not that big of an ice cream person. I do, as you know, we have gone out for frozen yogurt. You know that I do like to indulge, but I don't have that reaction when you and I meet in the afternoon.
Aha.
And have, it's because we're walking.
Yeah.
I'm active. Yeah. So ice cream before bed.
In ice cream, because sugar is a trigger, because you find it, what it causes, probably inflammatory.
Or it's a fluctuation in my blood sugar.
Aha. All right.
The drop in the blood sugar and all of that. So Tina, what do you know that causes a hot flash? Cause I don't know if anyone truly, do we truly know what causes a hot flash?
Party line is no.
Right.
You look it up. I looked at anatomy of a hot flash. I mean, we know roughly what does it. We know the hypothalamus, which controls,
it's in your brain.
It's in the middle of the brain, and it controls your body temperature, thermoregulation, if you want the technical term, thermoregulation. So if you get too hot or too cold, your hypothalamus kicks in. And put it in the simplest terms, a hot flash is a knee-jerk reaction. The hypothalamus gets the wrong signal. It thinks for a moment that your body is overheating. So the signals that go to the hypothalamus signal it to say, oh, you got to break out in a sweat because your core body temperature is getting too high. When in fact, of course, every woman who has hot flashes knows it's not happening prior to the hot flash. The hot flash makes you feel like you got hot, right? But what you're really feeling when you break out into a sweat is a reaction to what your brain thinks is an overheating. And so it breaks out into a, your body breaks out into a sweat to get rid of what it thinks is the excess heat. And then doing, you know, vasodilation, which means it opens up the blood vessels, causes you to turn red because your blood vessels are wide open at your skin level. So that makes you look reddened. And it usually starts, you know, in the head, neck area and works its way down. Heart rate goes up. So there can, there's like a sympathetic nervous system, like that's like adrenaline kind of thing that happens or it feels like that. It's actually a different hormone called norepinephrine, but in any case, yeah, it all starts with the hypothalamus. At least there's consensus on that, right? There's consensus that that little thermoregulation is what's off. What's fascinating, I actually looked up a little information about like, okay, how many women on tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitors have hot flashes? How many women normally would have hot flashes, percentage-wise? Right. Well, it's pretty darn close. 75% of women have hot flashes, no tamoxifen in sight, just menopausal hot flashes, which, you know, perimenopausal, postmenopausal, they last for whatever. Could be 6 months, could be 6 years, could be till they, you know, till the day they die. It could be anything. In any case, 75% of women regular, no breast cancer history, have hot flashes, 80% of women on tamoxifen.
Is that because of the, oh, well, no, because I guess tamoxifen is typically premenopausal. Yeah. Huh.
Right. So what you do is now you have hot flashes in premenopausal women. The severity is worse on tamoxifen.
Interesting.
So when I looked at that, I was like, well, this is kind of an interesting thing. So tamoxifen, just so we're clear to anyone who might not know this already, generally speaking, tamoxifen is the preferred anti-estrogen agent post-breast cancer in women who have not gone through menopause yet. So they have functioning ovaries. They still are cycling. Tamoxifen is the drug of choice. Generally speaking, postmenopausally, it's an aromatase inhibitor, which blocks the production of estrogen in fatty tissues for the most part. So,
and women who have been on tamoxifen, when they transition to an aromatase inhibitor, if their hot flashes were controlled or they didn't really have them with tamoxifen, they may get them with the aromatase inhibitor.
Yes.
Yeah. Because of the action of the medication.
Yeah. So, there's a little bit on the aromatase inhibitor being a little bit less persistent than tamoxifen. Like tamoxifen hot flashes, if they set in, generally you can control them. You can manage them with some things that you and I are going to talk about, but they don't change over time. Like if you're on tamoxifen for 5 years, when they looked at studies, 80% of women on tamoxifen have hot flashes in year one, year two, year three, year four, and year five. There was no huge drop off in the data. And aromatase inhibitors, it's different. And aromatase inhibitors, it's like they have hot flashes in the first 6 weeks, a few months, 3 months maybe, and then they drop off. And I think that has to do with the difference between still having a fluctuation up and down with tamoxifen and the aromatase inhibitor. Once they have been on it a while, there's essentially almost no estrogen in circulation. So there's no fluctuation of the estrogen hormone in those people.
And that's what's happening, is that this reaction, this hot flash reaction, is coming from a fluctuation.
Yes.
So if they were to go off of tamoxifen after 5 years, 10 years, and then, because that's not going to completely block their hormones, they may have hot flashes coming off of it. So it's not necessarily a dip in estrogen, it's a change in the hormones.
Yeah. And that reminds me, I think some people think tamoxifen blocks estrogen. The actual term for what tamoxifen is a selective estrogen receptor modulator, a SERM.
SERM, yeah.
S-E-R-M. And I know we're not discussing that today, but it's an important concept that every tissue gets its estrogen blocked. So this makes it a little more confusing to understand tamoxifen's role in the body, because it could be anti-estrogenic on breast tissue and breast cancer cells, and it is, but it's pro-estrogenic on other tissues. And that kind of throws a whole layer of of complexity to understanding what it's doing in someone's body, because it depends on the tissue, not on the molecule tamoxifen. So I'm just saying that as an aside, because it becomes confusing sometimes, and just keep that in mind. And we'll talk about SERMs and maybe another time.
Right. So thinking about myself, mm-hmm. being, you know, having been a cancer patient, I remember when I first got my hot flashes, I was given a drug called Gosserilin to block, to basically shut down my ovaries. Could be temporary, could not be. I mean, who knew? I was 46 years old, so they didn't know which way it was going to go. And I remember, because I'm getting chemo, so I remember like waking up sweating and hot and thinking like, oh, I have a fever. It's like what they warned me about. And so I'd get my thermometer, I'd take my temperature, and I was like, I don't have a fever. And so, yeah, that was a fun little surprise. And I also, another little thing, which I think is kind of amusing, but I've had patients tell me the same thing, is I would sweat like in strange places. So it was like my elbow pits between my breasts, and I think my neck were like the main places. Like, it wasn't like I was completely drenched unless I had a glass of red wine. And then I would just completely get blanketed in sweat. Mm-hmm. But yeah. And we'll hit on triggers. So that was just an interesting thing, is that it wasn't like what I thought night sweats or hot flashes would be, because night sweats and hot flashes, we kind of use interchangeably, but yeah, my elbow pits would sweat, and I don't recall ever that happening in any other situation. So, but I've had patients say the same thing, like, oh, it's my, like between my breasts and my elbow pits. And I'm like, ah, I know that. Well, so let's kind of go into triggers, because I kind of mentioned we mentioned sugar at the beginning, and then I touched on red wine. So
can I say one thing about chemotherapy before we jump into triggers?
Oh yeah.
Women who have had chemotherapy are twice as likely to have severe hot flashes than those who did not have chemo as part of their treatment.
Well, there you go.
Just a little factoid.
That's fascinating.
That's it. That's all I have to say. Go ahead.
No, that's really interesting. Yeah. Or special.
In so many ways, Leah.
So many ways. I know. Okay. So triggers for hot flashes. Sugar. Sugar is a big one. So we'll put that as a category. We'll say, so like, I guess diet could be a trigger, right? So sugar.
Well, when you say that, do you mean ingestion of sugar or blood sugar?
Both. Because ingestion of sugar, so blood sugar, right? Blood sugar could be ingestion of sugar, mm-hmm. skipping a meal, mm-hmm. you know, or being on like a specialized diet where they're not getting enough foods to help to stabilize their blood sugar throughout the day.
Makes sense. Yep.
So that is, and these are like triggers other than like the medication that you're taking or that the chemo that you've been through. So that is a big trig.
What else we have? What I suspect is happening when sugar does do this, there's a couple things that could be happening, but one of them, I think, because a lot of times, especially white sugar, can be worse than natural sugars for some people, or sugar all by itself. Sugar, especially white sugar and, you know, kind of the straight up sugars, can cause inflammation in the body. And that background inflammation may contribute to the sensitivity of triggering a hot flash. So one thing that there's also consensus around the idea of women prone to hot flashes, and this is a generic, this was whether you're on tamoxifen or just postmenopausal hot flashes and never had breast cancer, women who are more prone to hot flashes have a smaller zone, their body, their hypothalamus ultimately has a smaller zone before it jumps to a conclusion about your body temperature. So in other words, you know, I don't have hot flashes. Okay. So maybe my body doesn't have shivers until, like, I don't get cold shivers until it gets, I don't know, 40 degrees, 45 degrees out. And I don't really sweat until I get to, you know, an environment that's, oh, I don't know, my core temperature goes up enough in an environment that's 100 degrees or 110 degrees. And someone with hot flashes, their body responds differently to those environments. As their core temperature goes down, they might get shivers at 55 degrees, 50 degrees, and they might start sweating at 90 degrees. Literally, the zone in which they begin to shiver and sweat is smaller. The temperature zone is smaller.
And that's just anyone.
This is true on or off the drug.
So people who have like, they're like, okay, my comfort zone is from 70 to 80 degrees is somebody who might be more prone to hot flashes. Right.
Yes.
So someone who has a tighter comfort zone, or what do you, like more narrow comfort zone. Interesting. Yes. Oh, interesting.
It's very interesting because they've done enough studies on this. And again, it's all coming from the hypothalamic processes, the signals that are going to it. I think of it like a knee-jerk reaction, or so it's overreacting. It's 90 degrees in the room. It's not really objectively time to sweat, but the hypothalamus goes, ah, and that whole, it triggers the entire, you know, events that unfold after that cause hot flash. So anyways, I thought that was it's an interesting thing, because there is a little bit of you've probably heard this before. If for people who aren't on any drugs like tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitors or the the anti-androgen agents, if we're talking to men with prostate cancer, for women, if your mother had hot flashes, you're more likely to have them. It's always been kind of the way of thinking about it. And it may have to do with a little bit of this hardwiring about thermoregulation.
Oh, wow.
So anyways, I thought that was a very interesting thing to think about, and why we can't completely 100% always control it, right? We can influence it, diet. Let's go into more triggers.
Yeah. So what you're saying about inflammation how we're talking about diet. I mean, that could also be like food sensitivities.
Yes. See?
Yeah, because I have had patients say, when I eat a certain food, it gives me a hot flash, and it might be something that they have a food sensitivity to. Meat. I mean, people get meat sweats, right? I mean, there's something called meat sweats.
There is?
Yes. You've never heard of the meat sweats?
No.
You eat too much meat? I don't know. It's a thing. It's a thing. I know. Talking to the vegetarian.
Oh. No,
so red meat, especially.
Okay.
And
that can be inflammatory depending on its source, especially.
Exactly. Or it could be, would that be histaminic?
Only if it's been sitting around a while.
Okay. So an aged
meat. Or if it's an aged steak. Meat. There are aged meats.
Yeah. So histamine is another potential trigger. Smoking. That was always, you know, the
classic.
The classic, you know, the patient who's like, I don't know, I only seem to get hot flashes when I smoke.
Did you say now you have several more reasons to quit?
One more reason to quit smoking.
Can we put that in the con column when the pros and cons?
Yeah. So, and then temperature changes, you know, like walking into a room and it's a really hot room, it's a really cold room. That can definitely, because like what you were saying with the hypothalamus. So we have those, stress.
Mm-hmm. Before we get off foods, can I encourage people to do a food diary?
Oh, that's perfect.
Cause you could, you know, in clinic, we test people's food sensitivity. We do all this stuff, but to be perfectly honest, the only real great way of doing this and doing it without spending a bazillion dollars is write down everything you eat, then track your sleep. Don't look at it day in and day out, because it's hard to see things in real time. You do it for 2 weeks straight or so, and you see if there's any correlations.
No, that's perfect. I actually prefer that to getting food sensitivity testing in this situation, because that can open up a can of worms.
Yeah. Yes.
So, definitely a food diary, a diet diary is a great way. And then that way you can be like, oh, it's when I eat corn or whatever it may be. It's when I eat tomatoes, you know?
Yes. It's much more reliable, and then, you know, take out, whatever you think is it. And if you take it out and you sleep better and you don't have night sweats, then that's confirmation.
And when you, if you eat it, go into it knowing that when I have chocolate, ice cream, whatever, cake, that's what's going to happen. Yeah. You're just prepared. No, that's excellent. stress, which actually, if you think about it, stress includes food sensitivities, inflammation, all of that is stress on your body. But that, you know, there's like that mental, emotional aspect of stress that also, you know, not only being in a stressful situation where you break out in a sweat, but even recalling a stressful situation can also trigger a hot flash. Speaking of stories, I did tell you the story the other day about my hot flash stressful trigger on driving. When I used to drive to the cancer center, and I would go from one highway to another, and I would take the on-ramp to a major highway, interstate. And it was really stressful because people are coming in from behind you and they're trying to go to the right. And then you're trying to merge onto the highway to go left. And every single time I would come to that ramp, I would just break out in a sweat on my way to work, like freshly showered, everything, la 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 la, maybe yeah. Air conditioning on, windows down, didn't matter. And then I would get to that and I would, and if I went to work and I recalled something that happened traffic wise, like on my way to work, which often happened when you're driving on the interstate in Arizona, I would start to sweat. So yeah. So stress and recollection of a stressful event definitely is a trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just me. I mean, you talk to anyone.
Yeah. Yes. And when you say stress, you're saying like a stressful event, not like a constant stressor. But more like events that trigger a flash right then and there.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it could be somebody who's constantly under, you know, a stressful situation, but yeah, I'm thinking more, that change, that, mm-hmm. that stress, that, you know, the sudden change. I have two more things that I can think of offhand, and those are kind of the ones that make people go, oh, caffeine.
Oh,
right. So caffeine definitely is a trigger. And then alcohol.
Oh,
right.
Was that on cue?
That was perfect. Yeah.
Thank you. I didn't that one, they were both sincere, to be honest. I mean, I do like my coffee and I think I would be super bummed if I couldn't have my coffee and just enjoy it without consequence. That would bum me out.
Yeah. And sometimes switching to a decaf, helps.
How about cold brew? Does the acidity have anything to do with it? If you did a cold brew coffee, do you think that might help?
I don't know. I never experimented. I mean, I give up caffeine for other reasons, but, and I drink cold brew anyways. Being in Portland, cold brew is a thing.
Yeah. We should explain what cold brew is. How do you make your cold brew?
I grind my beans and then pour them into a giant mason jar and then let them sit in the appropriate amount of water for however many beans I put in there and let it soak overnight. And then I take a pour over Chemex, whatever they're called. And then I put my filter in there and then I filter out the grinds in the morning.
So one could do that and just use your regular coffee filter, paper coffee
just
filter.
A coffee filter, yeah. Just any sort of like Melitta pour over type of a thing. You just use a coffee filter into another container, another receptacle, and you filter out the grinds. And it's a much smoother coffee.
It's much super less nice. Acidic without the heat.
Without the heat. And then I filter it. I don't just like put it, some people put it in a bag, like you're making cheese or...
Oh.
Like your or any other like a giant tea bag type thing, you know, and they kind of squeeze it out or whatever. I don't do that. I filter it again through a paper filter.
Okay.
And so that makes a smoother coffee. Recipe tips.
Okay, so if I was someone having hot flashes and someone said my caffeine could be doing it, I would try that and I would cross my fingers.
Yeah. And then I mean, you know, people can always switch down to I mean, we're kind of getting into our integrative approaches, but I guess it's appropriate. People, you know, you can switch, try doing half calf, you know, kind of reducing your caffeine intake and, you know, doing that. I mean, if you're putting sugar and like milk and, you know, you're having like a, you know, frappuccino type thing every morning, then that's a whole another issue. But if you're drinking black coffee, if you're like, okay, I'm not going to do the sugar because it obviously makes me have hot flashes, but I'm still having them, it could be the caffeine. And I mean, who knows? That could be, yeah. creating a stress. I mean, right. It's
I'm like anyone, I'm in a deep state of how do I make this reality a different one? I don't like this reality. I'd like to change this reality. So I'm just, that's why I'm like, you know, grasping at whatever.
You know, when we get there, we will approach it. Speaking in the royal we.
Oh, okay. I like that.
Yeah, we will approach it. So yeah, so alcohol is the last one. Alcohol is another thing that affects your blood sugar. Correct.
Yes.
I, from my experience and you know your experience with patients, it tends to be red wine that does the most damage. And I mean, I literally remember sitting outside in Arizona at a restaurant. It was beautiful weather with a girlfriend. We both ordered a glass of red wine. And she's like, "Are you hot?" I'm like, "I guess maybe I have a fever." And my face was flushed, and I just had it was like a fountain. It was like someone had a hose on my head, and I was just like sipping the wine, like, "Oh, let me cool off."
Someone just flipped your hot flash switch.
They flipped my switch. Yes. So those are triggers, and we have, you know, our integrative approach, and we have our pharmaceutical approach.
One last trigger that we didn't mention.
Oh, what didn't we mention? Sorry.
So, and this is more of a trend than a trigger. Excess fat on the body, you're more likely to have hot flashes. So people with higher BMI have more hot flashes.
Or if they're a thin person but don't have as high of a muscle mass.
Yeah.
So and that was me. That's always been, you know, well, except for the period of time when I actually did lift weights. But yeah, I mean,
yeah,
that was often me where I was a thin person, but I didn't really have muscle.
Yeah. That I have a friend who called herself skinny fat because of that.
Yeah. No. And that's kind of, I would call myself that too. When I realized what was going on, I called myself that too. So yes. So definitely.
Just for the record, excess fat tissue also is an inflammatory background. So again, you go back to inflammation, because there's something definitely about a higher background of inflammation in the body, whether it's through foods or it's because you're holding excess fat. There, that excess inflammatory background, systemic inflammation, makes one more likely to have hot flashes, particularly in the night, but during the day as well. So the one thing, and I don't know if it's a trigger for you, but the one thing we haven't mentioned, for some people, spicy foods can also trigger.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, spicy foods for sure can be a trigger.
All right. With that, let's move on to what can be done about it, right?
Yeah. So in our next episode, we'll review both conventional and integrative approaches to hot flash management.